Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Will Summerlin. He is the artificial intelligence at ARK Invest. Previously, he started an AI security startup called Pin.ai, and he's also working in product management at Lyft. So today, I'm super excited. I want to dive into AI. Where is it headed? What's the future of AI? How can investors kind of look at the next 5 or 10 years to find opportunities? So Will, I want to welcome you on the show.
Thanks, Dave. Excited to be here.
Yeah, can't wait. We've got a lot of excitement regarding this episode. I posted it on Twitter asking for questions. We got hundreds of questions. Just people are really excited to try to understand AI, where it's headed. Personally, I think it's going to be one of the technologies, or maybe one of the dominant technologies that define the next decade. It's one of those, I think, historic type of trends and discoveries. How do you kind of, in the super big picture, like the 100-year or 1,000-year picture, how do you view AI and its significance?
Yeah, so, you know, just to kind of zoom out and put this into context, we did some research at ARK and found that the internet likely contributed about $13 trillion to global equity market caps. And we think that within the next 15 or 20 years, AI will contribute about $30 trillion. And so we think that this is going to be, you know, lead to even more value creation than the internet, which is one of the greatest sources of wealth creation humans have ever seen. And so that's just in the very near term. And I think in the long term, you know, AI is going to fundamentally change how humans exist. I think it's on par with the agrarian revolution. If you think way back to when humans went from hunters and gatherers to, you know, farmers. And I think the result of that was, you know, when humans didn't have to spend their lives trying to figure out how to stay alive and eat, they shifted to other activities that led to more productivity. And then that led to, you know, the industrial revolution and the technology revolution. And I think that AI is kind of the next big revolution. And so I think that, you know, in even in the near term, in 20, 30 years, the way that we exist as humans will be fundamentally changed by AI. And if we zoom out to hundreds or thousands or 100 or 1,000 years, it's hard to predict, but I think it will certainly be a much different existence than we have now or than we've had in the past.
Yeah. I think one of those themes is kind of, what are people going to do, right, with AI, let's say, you know, improving efficiencies and productivity? Where are jobs going to come from? Where are people going to shift into? We'll cover that later on in the conversation. I think it's a fascinating kind of big trend. Where is society headed? I'm wondering, like with AI, when I look at AI, we have, you know, the whole computer revolution, then right after the internet revolution, and right after now we have the AI revolution, and they seem to all, you know, come one after another and having huge implications. Like, what are you kind of most excited about in terms of, you know, AI, and how is it different than, let's say, the computer revolution and how the internet revolution revolutionized people's lives? Like, is this going to be something that is pervasive? Like people are going to feel, you know, the actual revolution, or is it going to be more kind of more subtle? Like, it's going to improve the back end, the processes of big companies and stuff. Like how do you view kind of this rolling out, generally speaking?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the promise of AI is that it will do the tasks that humans either don't want to do or just practically cannot do. And I think the replacing and augmenting tasks that humans don't want to do is probably what's going to be most pervasive and present in just people's everyday lives. So, for example, you know, driving cars. You know, some people enjoy driving cars. Very few people like sitting in traffic and driving to the airport. And so I think those are the types of automations that will come in the short term. I think those are the things that people will see on a day-to-day basis. I think what's actually more interesting, you know, from a sort of macro standpoint, is the impact on, you know, tasks that humans can't do. You know, we have limitations with just the knowledge of that the human brain has, and with traditional computers that AI can sort of unblock. And, you know, I was on a call this morning with a biotech company, and they were talking about how AI is massively reducing their drug development pipeline, or shortening their drug development pipeline. And so, you know, historically they had to test, you know, thousands of possible variations to come up with a solution. And now they can actually use AI to narrow it down to the 5 or 10 that they want to validate. And so thinking about healthcare and biotech and the impact there, I think it's going to massively accelerate the development of new products and new technologies I think that's probably going to have a bigger impact on society overall. But the automating things that we don't want to do is probably the aspect that people are going to see most in their day-to-day lives. Mm-hmm.
Like, besides autonomous driving, like, what are some things you think that we could see in the next few years? Specifically, like, things people don't want to do. It's just a hassle. I mean, first thing that comes to my mind is kind of like delivery, like, you know, going out to get groceries and, you know, all that stuff. So perhaps autonomous driving can, you know, find a way to pick up the food or the groceries. I mean, what other applications do you think might be out there?
Yeah, I think that's a great one. Obviously, food delivery, shopping, those are things that we don't enjoy that could certainly be automated. You know, I think that thinking about like stuff that you would do, you know, in the context of work. So, for example, accounting is something that can certainly be automated with AI, with less error than what a human would do, and more efficiently than a human would do. Contractor view is another one. There's actually companies right now that are building technology to automate the review of NDAs and other contracts. So if you're a lawyer, you know, most lawyers that I know don't like spending time in a Microsoft Word document looking at, you know, NDAs. It's very mundane, and that's something that can be automated. So this sort of low-level tasks, I think, will be automated in the short term. You know, and even looking into robotics and robotic automation, things like, you know, making a latte. Right now, you know, if you have a cappuccino maker at home, you might enjoy making a latte, but imagine that could be automated and it could be done more efficiently and produce sort of the perfect latte every time. But I think any task that you do that's repetitive is a low hanging fruit for automation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You noted on a tweet, I think, which caught my eye the most, you said that 1900s was defined kind of as the economies of scale as the advantage for companies. And in the 2000s, it was network effects. And then in the 2020s, you think it's going to be data advantages. Can you kind of expound on that? Like, because these are pretty huge, right? Title shifts, right? It's from economies of scale to network effects, now to data advantages. Like, do you think the network effects that we've seen in the past 20 years, like with social networks, with search, with just, you know, one user adding value to the entire network, do you think those advantages will continue? Or do you think somehow those advantages will just kind of be dwarfed by the data advantages in the next decade or two? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, they'll certainly persist, just as economies of scale have persisted. So if you think about the shift from economies of scale to network effects, economies of scale are certainly real. And if you think about, you know, a software company, you know, you can drive down your underlying costs to some degree, your compute and hardware costs, if you have huge amounts of data and huge amounts of compute scale. But the benefits you get from that are sort of marginal compared to the benefits you get from a powerful network, and unlocking that network effect flywheel. And I think the network effects will certainly play an important role in kind of having a data advantage. And just to kind of zoom out and talk about what a data advantage is, basically the idea here is that in the future, the most valuable companies in the world, in our opinion, will be AI companies. They will have AI embedded in their products and services. And generally speaking, with AI, the more data you have, the higher the quality of that data, the better AI models you're going to have. And if you have better AI models, hypothetically, you'll have more customers, and those customers will generate even more data. So you unlock this sort of flywheel effect where, you know, you basically create a moat where you have better models, more customers lead to more data leads to better models, et cetera. And you've got to run away, and it ends up in a winner takes most market in many circumstances. And so, you know, the challenge there is data acquisition, and network effects certainly can play a role in that data acquisition. So if you think about, you know, companies now, if you think about the social media companies, for example, they're acquiring a lot of data, and they certainly do have a data advantage. Think about ByteDance and TikTok and the effectiveness of their advertising algorithms. They're so good because they have so much data. And so while they do have that network effect, and that leads to value for the network and for their users, they're also sort of unlocking this data advantage. So I think companies that do have a network effect now, if they play it well, they can certainly develop a data advantage moving into the future. I think another example is a company like Tesla, which has, you know, lots of drivers on the road. They have hundreds of millions, if not billions, of miles collected using their, you know, their sensor system. And so that sensor system is basically compiling all sorts of data huge amounts of data, which they can use to train their systems and train their algorithms. And as a result, hypothetically, they would have a more performant system than competitors, which would lead to more customers and more data and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You noted also that, contrary to common belief, you tweeted that most data is useless or is of little value, but in a few circumstances, data is gold. So, I mean, that's a little bit counterintuitive for most people. Like, how do you kind of wrap your head around that? Or how do you explain that, that there's only certain types of data that are super valuable and a ton of data that just isn't very valuable? Like, how can you help us kind of, how can you enlighten us with that?
So I think there's two ways to measure the value of data. The first question to ask is this data hard to acquire? And so how hard would it be for a competitor to acquire this data? And the second question to ask is, how much data do you need to develop really performant algorithms? And where do you reach sort of the data asymptote or the point of diminishing returns? And so to give you like a practical example, at Lyft, you know, we looked at user data, not data about users, but data about users' behavior. So look at things like, okay, if we change a color on this button, will users click this button more? And, you know, we got a statistically significant sampling from 100 or 1,000 users. So we didn't need to roll it out to 10 million users to figure out whether changing the color of a button was effective or not. We just needed a very small subset of users. And so I think in those situations where you're looking at just product improvements or other applications like that, you really don't need a lot of data to, you know, create value or to understand what you're trying to understand. And so in those cases, you know, after 1,000 users, it doesn't really matter. We could have data from a million users and it probably wouldn't change the output of our experiment. So I think that's one aspect. And then going back to the first one, data acquisition, you know, if it's very hard to acquire data, the data tends to be more valuable. And so in the case of Tesla, you know, it's pretty hard to acquire like that driving data across, you know, different roads across the world in different conditions. And I highlighted an example to somebody the other day, which is parking lots in Hawaii. Some parking lots in Hawaii have blue stop signs. And, you know, it's I don't think I've ever seen a blue stop sign, but if you're an autonomous vehicle, you need to know that a blue stop sign is a stop sign. And unless you have cars driving in parking lots in Hawaii, you probably don't have that data. And so I think, you know, it is hard to acquire that data, autonomous driving data being an example, where, you know, you need sort of geographic scale. You need people operating under various conditions. The data is constantly changing. So you need to see how roads and conditions are changing. And so the sort of barrier to entry on that data acquisition is relatively high. Mm-hmm. And conversely, you know, if you're just looking at, you know, maybe data about driving on a freeway, you know, in a very small sort of geographic region, that data is relatively easy to acquire. You could send an employee out there with a car, drive up and down the freeway a few times and capture all the data that you need.
Got it. I mean, with driving, would you say like the way I'm hearing this is, so let's say driving, most of the data in driving is kind of pointless, useless, too common, but then there are these edge cases or these really difficult, like one in a million, like let's say blue sign or just, you know, strange object here, or those, that's the valuable data. Because if you could capture all of that data across millions and millions of points, then you're able to improve, you know, the driving capability of a car in all of those situations. Like, is that kind of one way to kind of understand this?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So most of the data that you would collect on a daily basis driving around wouldn't be super valuable, but the data from those edge cases is extremely valuable.
Got it. What's stopping, you think, other OEMs, other tech companies from gathering kind of massive amounts of driving data like Tesla does? I mean, could they hypothetically tack on, you know, some cameras and, you know, try to get that data? Can Google, you know, get some cheap Android devices, stick it on windshields, you know, to get a million cars, you know, driving around? Like, is that something that you think is there something fundamentally more or challenging about gathering that data than just doing kind of more of a simple, you know, adding sensors or adding a camera?
Yeah, I think there's a couple aspects. So there are some companies that are doing this to a degree. There's Comma AI, that's basically building, they had built hardware that you can just sort of, cameras you can stick on your windshield, and they're trying to collect large amounts of data through that mechanism. But I think that the data collection is one aspect of this, and then actually figuring out what to do with the data is a second challenge. So to talk through both of those, to begin with, to acquire all of this data, as you mentioned, the edge cases, Tesla doesn't want data from you driving on the freeway that they've seen 100 times. You know, that just creates noise in the system. And so, but they do want the data when you see a blue stop sign or when you have to slam on your brakes because, you know, the system didn't respond the way you expected it to. And so they want data on those edge cases. And typically speaking, the way that I understand they capture that data is if there is an intervention, it basically, you know, captures all the data around that intervention and then sends that data up to Tesla. And so, you know, Tesla has a large number of vehicles operating sort of a pseudo-autonomous state, whether it's autopilot or the full self-drive beta users. And you know, they're, in my opinion, ahead of the competition when it comes to, you know, users actually operating in a pseudo-autonomous state. Whereas if you look at, you know, any of the other legacy automakers, they just don't have as many people that would be operating in an autonomous mode and have an intervention where they had to break it out of the autonomous mode. And so I think that's one advantage that Tesla has when it comes to sort of data capture. I think the second is creating an incentive structure. You know, if a legacy auto manufacturer wants to start putting all these sensors in their cars, it's going to increase the price of the car. And if they don't have a competent sort of autonomous system, why would a user pay an extra $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 for a car with sensors that are kind of useless? And so I think that's, there's some price sensitivity. To your point, you know, a way around that would be to put, you know, Android on the dash or something like that. And I think in that sense, like, there's two challenges. One is, you know, it's not going to acquire high quality data necessarily. And the second is, again, user incentives. Why would a driver just put an Android on their dash for no reason if they're not getting anything out of it? So I think that's the other challenge. And then when it comes to actually making that data useful, that's really where a big challenge is, around labeling and around actually, you know, continually learning and putting that back into your neural networks and putting that back into your model. And I think labeling is something that is underappreciated, the complexity of effective and efficient labeling. And I think that, you know, Tesla has built up a pretty efficient way to capture those incursions, effectively label the data, and then create a feedback loop back into the system so that they can push that out in the next, you know, next software release. Mm-hmm. And I think that other companies just that I've seen just aren't quite there yet.
Mm-hmm. Can you help us kind of understand a bit, like what kind of, how big and momentum, like kind of how big of a task is it to not just capture, let's say, all of this data for autonomous driving, but actually to label it, to, you know, put into models, to train the models, to test the models, to, you know, do shadow mode. Like what are we talking about in terms of like operations or just the behind the scenes? Like what's going on behind, yeah, all of that?
Yeah. So, you know, Tesla is, from what I've seen, and you know, Andrej Karpathy was on a podcast recently, and I think you actually did a breakdown of it, which was really, really interesting. You know, they've gotten a lot better at automating sort of the feedback loop between collecting data from an incursion, you know, retraining the models appropriately, and then pushing that out. And I think they're continuing to sort of automate that cycle. I think historically, I won't speak for Tesla specifically, but historically the way that it would be done is you would essentially have an incursion, that data would come in and it would say, hey, you know, either the system either misrecognized this object or didn't recognize this object at all. And a human would look at it and say, okay, well, actually, you know, that's a stop sign, even though it's blue. And they would label that a stop sign. And then that would probably happen 5 or 6 more times. And then the neural network should be retrained. And then the next time it saw the blue stop sign, it would basically say, hey, this is a stop sign. And there is some more automation going into that process and pipeline. I would expect if we're thinking, you know, 2-3 years out, there will be even more automation. So that feedback loop will require much less human review than it does now or than it has historically.
Interesting. So with Tesla, are kind of been touting or sharing their plans of this Dojo supercomputer. And Elon has said, you know, this is a training kind of supercomputer. Like, how are you envisioning like the need for Dojo? Does Tesla really need a training supercomputer? Like, can't they just go elsewhere to do it? And then like, what does this mean? Is Tesla getting into like, you know, hardware, and are they creating a platform for, you know, AI training? Like, where is this headed in your opinion?
Yeah, it's a good question. So just to kind of zoom out and put this in perspective, I don't know if you're familiar with GPT-3, but just to kind of share GPT-3 as a frame of reference, it's a text language model that's trained on like most of the text on the internet. And so it's about 175 billion parameters, which is massive. So it's trained on like 500 billion words, I believe, from the internet. And so huge amount of data. And the training cost there was relatively high. I think it cost them a couple million dollars, about $5 million to train that model. And it took, you know, some time. It's not something that happens instantly. And that I saw an interesting sort of research and interesting thread on this suggested, you know, if you wanted to essentially try to model the human brain using currently available compute technology, the human brain is about 100 trillion synapses or 100 trillion parameters versus 175 billion parameters. So it's absolutely massive. It's orders of magnitude larger. Right now, with current compute hardware, it would cost about $2.5 billion to train a human brain. And it would take a long time. It would take many months, and it would take a huge amount of energy. And using the sort of current cost declines and increases in efficiency in neural network training, if you model this out to, you know, the mid 2030s, the early sort of 2032 is the number, it would cost us about $5 million. And so there is this sort of push commercially to reduce the costs associated with training huge amounts of data, but it hasn't been done yet, right? It's still something that's in the future. So I think one consideration is just the cost of training these networks. And I don't know what Tesla's current sort of cost structure looks like related to training, but I can imagine that the cost and the time it takes to train some of these really, really complex neural networks with huge amounts of data could be a factor. But I think a second factor that's probably more important is if you control the full stack, if you control the hardware and the software, you can essentially, you can customize your models and customize your hardware specific to the task that you needed to complete. And so if you think about the hardware that, you know, an NVIDIA or somebody else is producing, it's great general hardware, but it has to be used across a wide number of applications. It's not just used for full self-driving, for training, you know, visual neural networks for a Tesla system. It's used by other car manufacturers. It's used by you know, crypto miners for stuff there. It's used by other companies for other AI applications. It's used by biotech companies. And so they have to build a model that's good generally, not great specifically. Whereas if you control the hardware stack, you can build a model and build hardware that's great at a specific task. And so I think, you know, Tesla probably sees the advantage of going full stack there. They certainly saw it with their full self-driving computer within the car. I think they've seen another sort of vertical integration applications. So I see that as the real advantage here is they can build hardware and they can build software that's very, very specifically designed to do a single task or a single function, and, you know, accept the trade-offs of doing that.
Do you see Tesla having any like advantage over, for example, Google's TPU, you know, TensorFlow, like, because you have a massive company in Google who's invested a lot of time and energy developing, you know, their own neural net type of training hardware and platform. Is Tesla just being kind of just, do they just have hubris to try to go against, or, you know, try to think they can come up with a better solution? Or is there an opportunity because Tesla's approaching it from a different angle, like let's say more on vision, you know, like frames per second or real world AI, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I think it comes back to building hardware for a specific task versus building hardware to do sort of general machine learning or general AI. And I think a, you know, a analogy here is the SR-71 Blackbird that was built back in the, you know, back in the 60s. And it was, you know, the highest performing aircraft ever created. And in, I think it was 18 months, they went from concept to first flight. And it broke every record, right? It was Mach 3, it could fly it, I don't know, 100,000 feet or something like that. You know, and people look at that and say, well, that's insane. Like, how come we can't do that with commercial airliners now? And I think the reason was it was built for a very specific task. It was built for a very specific purpose and a very specific mission. And they made a huge number of compromises in order to accomplish that, right? It wasn't comfortable. The pilots had to wear spacesuits. You know, it leaked fuel on the ramp. It had to be refueled in the air, I think 8 times on a single mission. They had to build special, specially built tanker planes. And so they made all sorts of compromises, but it was able to do this one thing really, really well. And like, it was an engineering marvel in that context. And I think that, you know, the same is true to a degree here where, you know, they're optimizing for a specific function and a specific task, which is, you know, to train their neural networks for self-driving, versus building hardware that is generally, you know, general purpose across many different applications. And by doing that, they're able to accept a number of trade-offs, whereas, you know, a Google or anybody else who's building, you know, hardware is probably building it for more general application. And so I think that, you know, because of that, they could probably build hardware that's superior for their very specific task. But if you took the hardware and tried to use it, you know, in a biotech company for some application there, I would imagine it's probably going to underperform what a Google or somebody else is going to create.
Interesting. We've got a few questions from Twitter followers. So Sandeep Sharma says, do you have any insights on Dojo AI as a service and possible use cases and addressable market? And Dalibor Andrin says, what other problems can Dojo solve and how does Dojo compare to the rest of the marketplace? So, I mean, you brought up this interesting thing where, yeah, if you make something, you know, so specific, you know, in this use case, you can outperform the more generalized solutions. And perhaps, you know, Tesla is leaning in that direction, trying to solve, you know, full self-driving with that. But does that limit their total addressable market if they open up Dojo supercomputer neural net training as a service, because it's only advantageous in certain cases? And if so, like, how big really is that market?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I know you're familiar with our Tesla model and Tesla price target. That's not something we included. It could be, you know, some surprise upside, but it's not something we modeled in there. And I think it's uncertain now, you know, how that's going to play out if they do decide to release that as a service, you know, where it's going to focus and what that market looks like. You know, I will say if they build a piece of hardware, if they build Dojo very specifically focused on sort of full self-driving, then they're naturally building something that's optimized for, you know, for handling sort of neural networks in a visual context. And so capturing images and capturing short video clips, and doing things like distance learning and everything else within that context. So there are other applications that would use that. If you think about, you know, drones, for example, drones can use visual systems, other transportation systems are visually based. Some robotics and sort of factory automation we've seen are using visual systems. So I think there are other applications that are using kind of a similar approach as Tesla is using for full self-drive. And, you know, if they're optimizing for that specific task, then there certainly could be some overlap there. But again, if they're optimizing for that, and then you take it and you try to, you know, if you try to use it to train GPT-3, I would imagine it's, or GPT-4, I guess, in this case, it's probably not going to be the most performant approach.
Yeah, interesting. So I had this idea I wanted to toss out to you. And I have no idea if what the market or the, you know, demand would be, but could Tesla release kind of a API service? And it's probably not obviously going to be the whole, like, that's not the whole web service or neural net training as a service, but just let's say it's a minor feature. But what if Tesla had an API where you could send it pictures or video, let's say a video stream, and it sends back basically everything identified in those streams, but not just objects. So it's not just objects, but it's also the distances, you know, between all the objects. So they use their whole, you know, kind of pseudo LiDAR, you know, object distance recognition, all that stuff. So they completely decode, you know, the image, but also let's say it's a live stream video, even, who knows, but some type of API where it shoots it back, but it's completely like decoded. Is that something you think that has demand at all? Or is it more like, you know, other companies will just develop that part of it themselves to, and then add on, you know, other things for their own use cases. Like, I know, what are your thoughts?
So if you think about, you know, Tesla's sort of strength in this scenario, I think there are certain things in that example that they would be good at. I would imagine they're probably better at, you know, distance recognition from a video clip than, you know, than other systems or other algorithms. It's kind of interesting. Elon tweeted that they're going to drop radar and move to a camera only system. That would suggest to me that they're probably pretty confident in their distance calculations and distance recognition from a video stream. I would say that there are other things that they're probably not great at right now, given their current data set. If you want them to identify a piano in an image, maybe a Tesla seen a piano on the road, that would certainly be an edge case. But I would imagine that, you know, that's probably not where their strength is. And it comes back to that data advantage and those data assets. And they have seen a lot when it comes to, you know, driving and road conditions and, you know, blue stop signs and all of that. But they haven't seen, you know, that's a very small percentage of all objects in the world. And so, you know, if you send them a video stream of somebody playing a piano, they might be able to tell you that piano is 5 feet away, but they probably, with their current data set, probably can't tell you that that's a piano. That could change, you know, obviously, as they get more data. If they wanted to train a more general model and sort of ingest all the, you know, all the text and image pairs from the internet, I would imagine they could build a performance system. But it's just a question of, is that the direction that they want to go? Or do they want to sort of stay focused on the application of full self-driving and maybe, you know, release certain sort of certain features like the sort of distance recognition or distance calculation.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So Elon Musk tweeted recently that, you know, like they're planning a Tesla AI day in late July of this year. And then he also says that he thinks Tesla can become one of the largest AI or at least shallow minded AI companies in the world. A play on DeepMind, right? My impression is like folks in the AI world, like generally speaking, like this is a pretty, you know, like this is very, I guess, capable slash there's a lot of, you know, credentialed high, you know, level people in this AI world, PhDs, you know, running around. Google is the ultimate probably public company who has, you know, the aggregation of a lot of these minds. My impression is that, you know, Tesla is not in the conversation, you know, of the top AI companies at all. I mean, it's just Tesla's way out there. So for Elon to actually insinuate that Tesla is first could be an AI company, but could become one of the largest AI companies, it seems like it's a really, really crazy out there statement. How do you interpret that statement? Is it something that is possible, or I mean, and like, how big can their AI aspirations become? Like, is it just going to be, you think, full self-driving, or is it something that, like, do you think Elon or Tesla has something potentially much bigger, you know, in play or in mind?
Yeah, I mean, Elon certainly doesn't lack ambition. And so I'm sure that he has a bigger vision in mind. And I think, you know, to the points that you made, it's two thoughts. First, you know, within the sort of AI research community, it's very, very kind of academic and research oriented. And very rarely do the big breakthroughs happen, you know, in a very academic setting. And so I think that the fact that Tesla is not associated with, you know, with that world, you know, could be a good thing. And I think that, you know, the AI, so the second point, you know, Tesla is one of the few companies that's really deploying AI at scale currently. You know, if you think about sort of the complexity of full self-driving and the amount of data that's required and the just the complexity of the neural networks and the systems, it's daunting. It's mind-boggling. And so, you know, I think Tesla has sort of proven to the world that they are competent and they are capable of developing, you know, really complex systems, AI systems. They're capable of operating at scale. And I think that's something that in and of itself is really interesting and a positive signal that they could be, you know, could be building something that's more broadly applicable than full self-driving. Just based on what we've seen so far, I think that their focus seems to be leaning towards full self-drive. And I think that, you know, it could change in the near future, but that's kind of where we're looking right now. And to Google and to DeepMind, it's interesting because they're kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum. They're doing really, really incredible breakthrough research. You know, if you look at AlphaFold, or you look at any of the projects that have come out of DeepMind, it's just mind blowing what they're working on. But it seems like it's still a little bit detached from commercial application. And so Tesla, on one hand, is like building this stuff in the real world. You know, it's being used every single day by, you know, hundreds or thousands or millions of people. Whereas DeepMind is working on equally impressive research, but it sort of seems more confined to a lab at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I kind of wonder if like Elon will recruit some people, you know? I mean, if Elon thinks Tesla is going to become one of the largest AI companies in the world, it would make sense that he needs some more AI brains, like, you know, maybe some of the top in the world. It's going to be interesting. Definitely.
That's the big challenge in AI right now. There are two challenges in AI. And so like from an infrastructure standpoint, you know, neural networks are pretty good. Like we have a pretty good understanding of how to train neural networks and how to manage them and deal with them. There are two challenges. One is data acquisition. And that goes back to sort of the data advantage and data assets. The other challenge is people. It ultimately comes down to people and finding really good, you know, data scientists and AI engineers. And there aren't that many of them. You know, frankly, there are probably a few thousand really good data scientists and really good sort of data engineers, AI engineers. And you know, there's a huge war to recruit those people. And Google will happily pay those people, you know, $1 million a year out of a PhD program and give them a great office and a great environment to work on. But I think what I've found in talking to those people is what really motivates a lot of them is working on real world hard problems. And so I think if Tesla can position it as like, hey, come work on real world AI problems today. We're solving the hardest problems. It's applicable here and now. I think that, you know, they'll be able to pull some of those people away, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting. Like I saw your tweet about, good AI engineers commanding over $1 million, like, you know, even in the early stages of their career. But it reminds me a little bit about like, you know, maybe about 10, 15 years ago, you know, software engineers, you know, they're such like the good ones, you know, were getting scooped up by some of the big companies, and they're paying, you know, like a lot of equity and a lot of salary, you know, and Facebook and Google were in this war. And, it's like, I don't think at that time people in the outside realized what was going on. Like they're saying, hey, this is like a great software engineer could do a lot, you know, it's very valuable. Yeah. And it reminds me a little bit right now. It's like a great AI engineer like can do so much. And that's why there's this, you know, this great war for, you know, the great competent folks who could really, you know, I mean, like it's with software too. It's like, you know, one stellar engineer can do the work of many, you know, many mediocre engineers. And I would imagine with AI, it's even maybe, it's more magnified in that, you know, like one stellar AI engineer can do the work of many, many, you know, mediocre probably engineers.
Yeah. You know, to give you an example from Lyft, you know, we had pods of engineers and, you know, data scientists and some AI engineers were embedded in those, and they were small, you know, a pod might be 5 or 8 people. And they were expected to produce products or features that would, you know, result in tens of millions of dollars of cost saving or sort of incremental revenue improvement for Lyft. And so if you think about that investment, if you have, you know, 8 people who are going to build a product over 6 months, it's going to result in, you know, a $20 million lift for a company, you'll happily pay those people $1 million a year, especially if they can crank out 2 of those products or 2 of those features a year. And so the cost benefit analysis there is such that, you know, it doesn't really matter if you pay somebody $1 million or $1.5 million, you're going to pay them whatever you have to pay them to attract the best and brightest.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to ask you about your perspective on real world AI. So, you know, Elon Musk has stated to solve full self-driving, Tesla has had to, you know, solve a lot of real world AI problems. And it seems like, in a sense, like they thought, you know, hey, full self, or initially I think that it feels like Elon thought that full self-driving was going to be easier than it was. You know, he wanted to do this cross-country trip, like, you know, several years ago. And it's proven like they've had to solve a lot of other issues. In your opinion, like, is there a divide that's taking place where you have more of this digital AI world, where you have the social media companies like the Facebooks And then you have, you know, Google and all these other companies using AI in the digital sense to improve digital products, to you know, profile people, improve their ads, rates, all that stuff, versus a real world, kind of more of a physical world AI, where you have this combination of hardware and software, and it's more about navigating like vision, et cetera. Do you see that kind of like dichotomy in a sense? Or, I mean, how do you view kind of the unfolding of what Elon is calling real world AI?
Yeah, I think that, you know, so it's interesting. I had a conversation the other day with a former executive at Google, and his thought on it was Alphabet as a company is really good at bits. They're not great with atoms, and that, you know, they're really, really good at software, and that's just embedded in the culture of the company. That's their history. But when it comes to manufacturing physical products, that's just not necessarily their DNA. And that could change in the future. It could be different, but historically that's been true. Whereas a company like Apple is great with atoms and not great with bits, right? Apple's software is in my opinion, not the best. iTunes is somehow still sticking around, and that's challenging. But they're incredible at atoms. They're great at producing physical products. I love their AirPods, love their iPhones, love all their products. I think Tesla is proven to be pretty good at both. I think they've proven to be pretty good at atoms and pretty good at bits. You know, they produce hardware that a lot of people love, and they produce software that's, you know, accomplishing some of the hardest problems in the world when it comes to sort of AI. I think that's a unique blend, and I think there's an advantage to that. And going back to our earlier conversation about, you know, owning the full stack and building all the compute hardware as well as the software, I think there's an advantage to having a culture and having a DNA that can produce both. And so I think that, you know, like from a sort of company culture standpoint, I think we're going to see that. I think we're probably going to see more companies that are good at atoms and bits. We're going to see more companies that want to own the full stack and vertically integrate. Because when you get into AI applications, there is a distinct advantage to owning the full stack. But I think some of the legacy companies, it's going to be hard. It's hard to transform a culture and a DNA. It's going to be hard for a Google to become good at hardware. It's going to be hard for Apple to become good at software. You know, and I think naturally the people that have historically worked on software will probably lean towards continuing to work on software. The people that have worked on hardware their whole careers will probably lean towards continuing to work on hardware. So to the extent that, you know, Tesla can pull from Apple for hardware and Google for software, I think they're in an advantage position. But I think that's probably how it's gonna play out.
Do you think Apple has a chance with their potential Apple car in the future?
Never underestimate Apple. I think they've, you know, they've produced great products in the past and certainly surprised the world. I think it is self-driving car is very much atoms and bits, right? It's, you have to have the hardware, and you also have to have the software, and that's not easy to do. I think they're coming at it. From obviously it's a very secretive program, so we don't know a ton about it at this point, but from what's been rumored or leaked, they're late to the game. You know, I think that they're at a disadvantage from a battery technology standpoint compared to, you know, to Tesla and some of the others. And I think from a software standpoint, you know, companies like Tesla are collecting just huge amounts of data every single day, and every single day their models and their algorithms are getting better and better. And, you know, I think Apple said that the rumors were like they're going to produce a car like within the next 5 years or something. Imagine how much better full self-driving is going to be in 5 years, and how much better the battery technology is going to be in 5 years. So I think they're late to the game, and they're certainly at a disadvantage. And even Waymo, you know, Waymo is going to have a lot more data in 5 years than they have right now. And their systems are going to be, you know, orders of magnitude more performant. And so, you know, if they end up partnering with somebody who has that data, who have those assets, you know, maybe that's a way to sort of jump ahead. But from starting from zero, I think they're certainly coming from a disadvantaged position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. It feels like if they would have entered the game like 4 or 5 years, like even three years ago, 2018 released a car at the same time as the Model 3, it would have been a different, you know, landscape, you know. But the later it goes, it's just, that's how much further Tesla is like going ahead with the data, you know, with the model, with the experience, with all of that. And it's just more and more catch up. And it's like, it feels like it's it could come to a point where it's like, whoa, it's just, you know, it's a kind of a tough one, you know?
Yeah. And going to using network effects as an example, imagine releasing a direct competitor to Facebook 5 years or 10 years after Facebook had launched and had millions or billions of users. It's just, it's going to be hard to catch up and sort of operate something at a similar scale.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. What's your take on LiDAR? So it seems like there's this bifurcation, this dichotomy of beliefs with full self-driving, where you have one camp that with Tesla, maybe comma.ai, but who believe vision only is the way to go. And then you have the vast majority, it seems like, of other self-driving, you know, programs feeling like either they need LiDAR and HD maps, or at least they think that it's going to be beneficial to add LiDAR, you know, to the mix. What's your take? Is LiDAR something you think is needed for, you know, full self-driving, or do you think that vision alone can do the job?
I think that both can do the job, but I think that vision is probably the better approach. And I say that for two reasons. Number one is just cost and scalability, right? If you need HD maps of you know, everywhere you want a vehicle to operate, and you need LiDAR hardware, that's going to become cost prohibitive, and it's going to limit your ability to scale, you know, across all use cases, across all geographies. And, you know, if you think about a car, going back to our edge case scenario, you expect an autonomous vehicle in 10 years to be able to pick you up in downtown San Francisco and drive you to San Jose. And, you know, along that journey, there's a lot of complexity and a lot of edge cases. You also expect it to be able to pick you up at the Grand Canyon and drive you to Las Vegas. And you know, if you think about just the sheer number of roads that exist in America and around the world, imagine trying to develop HD maps of all those roads. And then if you factor in the cost of actual LiDAR hardware, it could become cost prohibitive. So I think that's the first challenge, is sort of scalability. I think that the second challenge is, I wouldn't say this is a challenge as much as it is an opinion. Going back to that Adams and Bits conversation, I think if you're good at software, you don't necessarily need the LiDAR, right? If you have visual systems, if you have camera systems that can, you know, accurately predict distance and depth, and you know, you have really good software, you probably don't need that LiDAR as much. Whereas if you don't have that software, if you don't have the autonomous systems that are able to do that, you probably are going to lean on hardware a little bit more. And so I think that, you know, companies that are using LiDAR currently, one opinion would be that it's kind of a crutch. It's a hardware crutch because they don't have the software. There's a gap in the software, and they're trying to fill that gap with hardware. And I think in the short term, you know, that could work. Like if you look at Waymo's experiments in Phoenix, like, you know, you can go watch a YouTube video. One of my colleagues, Tasha, actually took a ride in a Waymo in Phoenix, and it worked really well. You know, it worked as expected. But that's in a very sort of controlled circumstance. You know, the roads are laid out. They've mapped those roads over and over and over again. And if you try to take that, if Waymo tries to take that and scale it across the country, you know, in a year or two, I think it's going to be challenging. And so in the short term, they're filling the software gap with hardware. In the long term, I think that's going to put them at a disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of ironic that the one of the best software companies in the world, Google, is like taking a little bit more of a, you know, sensor approach versus Tesla, this upstart, going all in on software, vision and AI. Yeah, it's an interesting kind of, you know, picture here.
I think part of it too, is the sort of incentive structure within these companies. You know, I think Elon and Tesla are very aggressive, and they're willing to take big risks. And look, those risks could have not worked, right? Tesla could have invested in full self-driving and this vision-only system, and it could have completely failed. And I think that they've kind of turned a corner on that, and proven that it has the possibility, has the potential to work as they expected. Whereas if you look at, you know, Waymo, which came out of Google, I feel like they took a more conservative approach. I mean, they've been working on this for what, over a decade, and I think a decade ago or 12 years ago, or however long ago they started, it probably did make more sense to use LiDAR. And I think that was sort of an entrenched decision that they made a long time ago. And I think that, you know, the incentive structure is such within the company that you know, they're not incentivized to take these really, really bold risks, and bet the company on a vision-only system. So I think it was an entrenched decision they made a long time ago that's just sort of persisted.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You tweeted this interesting tweet. You said founder-led tech companies tend to be more aggressive and risk-tolerant. They will push the limits and reap the benefits. I mean, it's kind of like what I get from that is it feels like you're saying like, hey, with AI, there's something risky about it or inherently like unknown. You don't know what the exact results are going to be, right? You have to try it out. And for a typical, let's say, risk adverse, you know, company or person, like it's kind of scary. But when you have a founder-led kind of, you know, ambitious person who isn't afraid to take those risks and see if those benefits will, you know, be accrued or not, like it seems like AI, if it kind of leans and favors those people, right, who are more ambitious, who are willing to go for it, make a mistake, you know, take some risks. And when you talk about Waymo and Tesla, it seems like Waymo took the more safer route, you know, the route that was more well known or had less risk. But Tesla took this very unknown, you know, route. They had to really like take risks, build stuff that hasn't been built yet, you know, for unknown results. Do you think that type of theme is going to be played out over and over with AI over the next decade, where you have kind of AI favoring the companies and the founder-led companies, the ambitious ones who just aren't afraid to see what AI uncovers?
I think so. And breaking that down into sort of the three reasons why I think that's true. Like number one, you have to be a little bit crazy to be a successful founder. The best founders that I know are a little bit crazy. They didn't want to work at Google. They didn't want to work at Facebook. They wanted to go out and try to build something and change the world and push the limits. They're the same people that get speeding tickets going, 100 miles an hour on a freeway. And so I think that just the personality of those types of people, they want to push the limits. They want to push the limits of what's possible. They want to fundamentally change the way the world operates. And so I think the culture of those companies kind of follows that. I think the second thing is, if you think about a typical sort of corporate structure, an average corporate company in America, and this could be true at a tech company or any other company, the incentive structure is such that for most people, they just want to keep their job. They want to get promoted every couple of years. They want to kind of climb up the ladder and they want to retire when they're in their 50s or 60s. And there's nothing wrong with that. But in that sort of structure and in that organization, you're incentivized to take as little risk as possible, right? You want to do just enough to sort of prove your value, prove your worth, but you don't want to take these big risks. And I think that that's true all the way up to the C-level. And so the people that are working on these problems day to day in sort of larger organizations, they're going to take sort of the lower risk bets and safer bets. And I think this is true even up to CEOs. If you have a hired CEO at a traditional corporation, they want to hit their quarterly earnings. They want to prove that they're, keeping things on track, and they're not really incentivized to take these huge bets. And so I think the sort of decisions within those organizations are kind of limited by the constrained by the incentive structure. Whereas at a founder-led company, a founder will just pop into a meeting and say, hey, I really think we should do this. It's a huge risk. Let's do it. And that gives everybody in the organization the authority to take that risk. Because if it goes wrong, like you're not, a middle manager is not responsible. It's like the founder said to do it. He said, hey, buck stops with me. I'm making the call. Let's try this. And so I think that gives people the authority and the freedom to make those kind of risks and take those bets. And I think third is, as a company gets larger and larger, especially if the founder's not there, it's easy for processes to sort of be put in place and you sort of add layers of bureaucracy in your view. And, the entire organization orients towards like minimizing risk. And so I think I saw a video for Mercedes announced their new EV. There were all sorts of, it was a tweet and it was like comparing kind of Tesla's demo day where they were talking about like the Roadster or something like that versus Mercedes, and Mercedes had all the little disclosures on the bottom of the video. And I think that's, that's, you can't read into that much, but I think it's an example of like how bureaucracy plays into it. And I'm sure there are teams of lawyers that watched that, video 100 times and had to make edits and comments and and add all the disclosures and language, and you know, that's okay. That's the way they operate. But I think as a result, you know, if you want to make a crazy decision, if you want to do something really bold, especially with AI, where you can't explain, you can't necessarily predict what's going to happen or explain to a lawyer within your company, like why it's doing something the way it's doing it. I think that they're sort of going to default to, no, that's too risky. Let's not do that.
Yeah.
And as a result, you know, they're going to probably wait until somebody else tries it before they decide to move forward.
Yeah. I think what a lot of people in terms of like in the outside world who aren't, let's say, familiar with AI don't realize is this stuff is changing so fast. Like we're still in the early innings. And when a company is embarking on some cutting edge AI project, you don't really know the results. You know, you don't know how it's going to impact the company's bottom line or revenue. It's really unknown because this is cutting edge stuff. You know, it's evolving and changing so fast, and so many different outcomes are possible. And that's why I think it's like kind of fascinating. And it also kind of seems like gives advantage to those who are willing to, you know, swing the bat to get a home run rather than just try to like, you know, do a single or something.
And many will fail, right? If you take risks, it's not taking these bold bets isn't risk-free. And I'm sure there will be companies that startups that try these really risky, bold things and fail. But I think what's going to happen is, you know, for every, this is just a guesstimate, but for every 99 that fail, one's going to become a $1 trillion company, right? And so I think it's certainly an interesting dynamic.
Yeah. So I want to dive in a little bit more to this real world AI. Tesla is, you know, let's say with their autonomous robotaxi cars, how close do you think they are to solving this? Like, do you think, you know, they just need to plow away with more data and training, or do you think this is still a ways out? Like, let's say at least several years out. What's your kind of time frame?
I think it's becoming an optimization problem at this point. You know, I think they've done the blocking and tackling to solve, you know, some of the challenges that seemed insurmountable a couple of years ago. And again, I think that, you know, that if they are really removing radar and they're this confident in their camera systems being able to detect distance, I think that's a huge, huge milestone. But I think that at this point, it's really about optimization. It's about, you know, getting to, you know, they've got 5 nines of reliability, and they're trying to get to, you know, 8 nines of reliability. And that last little bit, that last, you know, fraction of a percent is often the hardest, but I think that's where they're at. And I think they're just working on sort of optimization at this point. And I think they've solved many of the kind of blocking and tackling challenges that they needed to solve in order to build a system that could operate as we expect it to.
Do you think Tesla can take their AI vision experience and, you know, just plant it into a different robot, like a possible in the future, let's say 5 or 10 years down the road, let's say into a household robot or into like even something like a drone? Like, do you see a drone? Like, part of me feels like a drone is a large part of it is the brains, how the drone will, you know, navigate safely and interact with the world around it. And the other part is the hardware. But to me, it seems like that software, the brains is much more complicated than the hardware. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, what I've seen so far from Tesla is that their models are more specialized for full self-driving. And I think an analogy here is like, you know, teaching someone German versus teaching them French, right? They're countries that are next to each other. They're both in Europe. But they're different languages. And I think that, you know, right now they taught their car as German, and getting it to fly as a drone would be teaching it French. Not to say that they can't, but I think they have sort of a foundational layer that they can build on, right? If they've solved some of these really hard problems like distance, that could certainly be applied to drones. And I think it comes down to sort of the data advantage and collecting data of, you know, of flying versus collecting data on operating on roads. So I think they do have the foundations, and certainly they have the learned knowledge of how to build these systems at scale. And if they have the hardware components, right, they have the specialized hardware that's optimized for sort of running these camera-based systems, that could all be transferred over. But I think they would have to retrain probably the majority of the system for a specific task, like, you know, operating as a drone versus operating as a car on the road.
Mm-hmm. Do you think like for Tesla to retrain their let's say their AI for drones to fly and to build an AI, is that more difficult, or is it more difficult for, let's say, like a drone company to gain the AI type of expertise to really be top notch, as good as what Tesla could be if Tesla ported their AI over to, you know, flying?
Yeah, I think a company starting from zero is probably not as well positioned as somebody like Tesla. I think given it goes back to kind of two things in this case. I think one is just talent, right? If you're a startup and you're trying to build an autonomous drone, it's really hard to recruit away those people from Google or Facebook. I think the Tesla sort of has that recruiting flywheel going. And I think that they're probably, and they have the capital to invest, right? If you're a startup, it's hard to pay somebody $1 million a year. But if you're Tesla, you know, it's probably more viable. So I think one is they have a talent advantage, and they have, you know, organization where those people fit in, and they can sort of optimize the output of really smart people. And so I think, you know, from a talent standpoint, they're an advantage. And, you know, they do have, you know, the sort of the stack, this, right, this AI stack that they can build on. It's both the hardware, it's the, you know, sort of probably some of the underlying infrastructure components. It's how they train, it's their labeling infrastructure. All that can certainly be carried over. And I think that the data would be really the main difference, right? They would have to acquire a whole new set of data related to flying versus related to driving. Retrain their models with that data. But I think they would be, you know, certainly in a better position than a startup drone company when it comes to that, if they were willing to invest the resources in it.
Interesting. How about last foot delivery? So this is something I've been thinking about. It's like, let's say a robotaxi or autonomous car van delivery vehicle comes to your driveway. And there's obviously hundreds of different types of paths where, you know, you might be in an apartment, you might be in a house that has a lot of steps, or it might be just in a typical house, or there's tons of scenarios. But let's say in a scenario where a robotaxi delivery, autonomous delivery vehicle takes your, let's say, meal or package to your driveway, like how does it get to your porch? Like do they just dump it on your driveway, or do you think AI will, and combined with robotics, somehow we'll find a way to get that package or that food or whatever to your door or not? Or do you think, or do you think that's just kind of something where people will just find ways to create lockers or something, you know, where, you know, the vans can just put them, or will people have to go out and pick up, you know, their food or stuff? Like how do you envision this happening over the next, let's say, 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think stairs are uniquely challenging. I don't know if you've seen any of the Boston Dynamics videos on their robots, you know, dealing with objects like stairs. It's and I don't know, just tangentially, they had a really interesting dancing video. It was a little bit creepy, but I think that's a really hard problem to solve. And, you know, companies like Boston Dynamics have been working on that for a while. But zooming out, I think if you think about this in first principles, and you really just want to get, you know, a food item from point A to point B, you know, probably a less challenging way to do it is to use a drone. If you have a drone, all you really have to deal with is the takeoff, the landing, navigation, and sort of object avoidance in air and during the kind of takeoff and landing phase. Whereas if you, you know, want to use a vehicle and then somehow use like a smaller robot to go from that vehicle door to door, you have a lot more to deal with, right? You have to deal with stairs. You have to deal with dogs trying to bite the robot. You have to, there are all sorts of edge cases you have to deal with. And just like the physical manipulation of that robot would be more challenging when you think about stairs and ramps and everything else it has to overcome. So I think if you're thinking about that in first principles, drones seem like a more efficient way to solve that problem. And I think that's probably going to be the case. I'm sure there are edge cases where robots will be more effective, and I'm sure companies will find those edge cases and try to build for them. But if we're talking about just kind of mass market adoption, I think drones are a more natural sort of vehicle to go from point A to point B in that scenario.
Do you think the public will be accepting of the noise factor with the drones, you know, flying above their heads or, you know, in the sky, like all these drones with packages, Amazon packages and food and all this stuff? Or, I mean, like for example, like some people, they live in an HOA and the HOA could make a rule against, you know, flying drones because of the noise, because of the nuisance. Or do you think, are there some stuff with technology where they'll make it more silent? And I don't know, have you looked into this at all?
Yeah, I think noise will be somewhat of a solved problem. There's a company, Joby Aviation, just building, trying to build like a flying taxis essentially. And you know, they have a video where their CEO is talking while one of their taxis is taking off behind them. And you can barely hear it. It's almost indistinguishable. And if they're able to do that with a vehicle large enough to carry humans, I would imagine that, you know, if you shrink that down into a drone that's able to carry a package from, you know, point A to point B, I would imagine that the noise won't be a huge problem.
Interesting. So, Will, I've got like so many questions here, and I feel like it's a good spot to actually maybe cut our interview into part one here, where, you know, we've talked about Tesla, we've talked about the foundation of understanding kind of AI versus real world AI, drones, different possibilities going forward. But then there's a whole nother section of questions and thoughts where I want to ask, like, what industries overall do you think could benefit from AI? I want to ask your opinion on companies like Palantir, who are helping companies analyze data using AI, et cetera. And I want to kind of try to get a glimpse of, you know, what kind of advantage we can have in terms of the next 5 or 10 years, understanding kind of where AI will propagate and create value. So if you don't mind, we'll go ahead and wrap up part one here, and then we'll go ahead and start a part two for this interview in a few minutes here. Thanks.
Sounds good. Thanks, David.
Cool.